Welcome to the University of Washington's Political Economy Forum. We bring together diverse scholars, policymakers, and citizens to discuss current public policy issues, to inform the public about them, and to find evidence-based solutions. Feel free to visit our website at uwpoliticaleconomy.com. We publish new episodes of this podcast every week. If you have questions or suggestions for discussion topics, please contact us on Twitter at ForumUW or email us at uwpoliticaleconomy@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Nicholas Wittstock, and in this episode, I speak to Jan Eckhout. Jan is the ICREA research professor at the University of Pompeu Fabra. He is also the BSE research professor and professor of economics at the University College of London. Jan is also the author of The Profit Paradox, How Thriving Firms Threaten the Future of Work, which is the object of our conversation today.
Hello, Professor Jan Eckhout.
Hello. Nice to meet you, Nick.
Yeah, nice to meet you too. We're very happy to have you on the podcast. Jan, you're the author of The Profit Paradox, in which you argue that dominant firms are the root of a host of economic and social ills, both across the US and Europe. And you begin the book by suggesting that there are several prevalent myths, both about work and the labor market. What are some of those myths?
Well, there's a number of developments in the labor market that have started probably in the 80s and 90s. And they have been known for a while, and economists have been looking at them. So let me give you one example. One is the fact that most people would think that the duration of jobs have become shorter, that jobs basically have become much more risky, and that's actually not the case. They've become longer. The duration of jobs is longer. It also means that people turn over jobs less frequently. Migration within the United States, so I mean like moving state or moving city, has declined. It's about half as frequent now as it was three or four decades ago. Most people would say that we move about much more frequently. It's true, we fly around much more often because, you know, we go and visit family maybe more easily than we used to do 40 years ago. But moving house from one state to another or from one city to another is actually at lower frequency. Another one, which is not necessarily directly the labor market, it's closely related, is I think my favorite one, and I kind of use it to jokingly be a little bit unpopular at your typical cocktail party, that that today there's fewer startups than there were in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. And people say, wow, this is the digital age. I mean, you know, this is all about startups today. I mean, this new technologies, they come out of startups, and startups are really the embodiment of that new technology. But if you look at the facts, that's not the case. And it's even true in California. So, you know, kind of the homeland of startups, also there's fewer of them. So it's one of these facts that, you know, you would say, I have a preconceived notion of what it would be like. And then reality is different when we actually measure it. Economists have known this for a while, in the sense that people, you know, who study these things, at different points in time have noticed that there's certain what we call secular trends, because these are very long-term changes. Long-term for an economist is a few decades, as opposed to, say, business cycle changes, where we had a recession, you know, now with COVID in 2020. We had another one before in 2008. That's a slightly lower frequency. It's still long enough. It's still, you know, 10, 12 years, but still, when we talk about these secular trends, we're really talking, you know, since the 80s, there's these developments.
Yeah, interesting. So let us get into the question of why, you know, some of these things are both a cause of concern, but also get into the question of, you know, what is at the root of some of these phenomena, right? You make the very fervent case that ultimately it's all about dominant firms. It's about market power. It's about the fact that a few companies have put themselves into a position where they effectively do not really have to compete as much anymore. And that then causes a lot of these downstream effects. So maybe just to start this conversation, what exactly do you mean with market power?
Market power means that literally a firm can price a good that it sells, and that could be a service, of course, as well, that is higher than what it really costs to to produce. Now, of course, firms make profits, and so if you want to make profits, you have to have some margin. It's the extent to which, and there's different ways to measure it. It's by profits. It's also what we call the markup, which is literally the margin, as in, you know, how much does it cost to produce, say, a pen to write with, and how much do I sell it for? And of course, that cost to produce, it probably doesn't take into account some investments, it doesn't take into account some other stuff. But it's really that margin, that difference between the price at which you sell it and the price that it, or the cost that it is needed to produce it. And that margin really has gone up substantially. I mean, it was about 20% in the 80s, it's 60% now.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing with profits. Profits were about, you know, between 1-2% of total sales in the early 80s. Today, it's rather 8-9%. And these are indicators. And this is, by the way, on average. And the key thing is that this is not going to everyone. This is going to a small number, but all these firms are very large. These are what we call dominant firms.
Mm-hmm.
And these large firms manage to charge prices that are more than 60% over their cost. They have substantial margins. And actually, the vast majority of firms in the United States, is about 6 million firms. And the vast majority of those firms don't have an increase in their profits or in these margins. And the firms, the small number of firms are basically accounting for all that change. And when I say small, really of the big ones, there's only a few hundred of those.
Mm-hmm.
These are global firms, they're everywhere. Many of them, of course, located in the United States, but these are firms that are globally active. And the whole point of this market power is that we see, for some reason, these firms manage to have a market in which there's no competition.
Mm-hmm.
Because your typical Adam Smith logic is that if I can make profits that are much higher than compensating for whatever risk and investments I've made, then someone else will come in. Because if you can take a huge profit out of it, I come in and I say, I do the same business.
Mm-hmm.
The way I'm going to do this is I'm going to try and get some of your customers. How do I do it? Sell at a lower price. If I sell at a lower price, my profits are going to be slightly lower, but you're going to respond, and you're going to respond up to the point where basically we get to a price level that's what we call competitive. And that's not the case now for many markets. Now, the question is, and you hinted to that, why is that the case? Why is it that there are such markets? And one of the reasons is that with the new technologies, in the digital age, these technologies, I always say they're both the kind of the hero and the villain of the movie of the economy today. Because they're the hero because these technologies have brought, you know, amazing progress and amazing things that we couldn't do just a few decades ago. And that has changed the quality of life, that has brought growth, that has brought progress. But at the same time, these technologies have certain aspects that make them into the villain, because these firms who maximally exploit those technologies also not only bring value, but they also manage to keep out competitors. Let me give you an example why that is. And the keyword here is really returns to scale, or scale economies, as we call them. And that says these technologies work best if they're large. And let me give you the example of eBay. eBay came around in the mid-90s, and it's a platform to buy and sell stuff, anything. And of course, before it didn't exist, you went to your maybe Sunday market in town and you could buy and sell some, you know, used books. But it wasn't a very efficient market, because you were looking for a particular book on I don't know what topic, and it wasn't at the market, it was at Next Town's market, and you didn't go there.
Uh-huh.
So eBay, of course, created this huge global exchange. But that global exchange really works extremely well when it is large. When you're a seller, you want to be where all the buyers are. And if you're a buyer, you want to be where all the sellers are. And so it doesn't make sense to have two parallel platforms.
Right.
And so, in fact, Yahoo Auctions has tried to do this for a long time. They tried to get into this market. But even though they were offering much better deals, like lower commissions and lower fees to be on that market, no one switched, not because they didn't like lower commissions and fees, but because they wanted to be where the value of the market is, i.e. where the other traders are. And so it makes sense to have one huge platform. But that means, and this is the villain part, that an eBay can say, you know, I charge you 7% for each transaction. It doesn't cost them 7%, it costs them 0.5% or less, but they still can do that because you don't want to switch. And this is what I was referring to before. These are these economies of scale that in this case come from what we call network effects, that you want this to be a large network on which you're active. And the new digital technologies have a lot of that aspect, these economies of scale. And if you look into it carefully, you'll see that we have no problem with dominant firms, with monopolies in producing pens and producing bikes and producing, you know, you name it, but we have problems in these technologies exactly where there's these scale economies. And the new technologies have that aspect naturally in them because, you know, a social network, what is it, a network? What is, you know, why is it that Amazon as a distributor does so well? Because that platform for buying and selling is so efficient when it's large. And that distribution network, which in the end is a traditional brick and mortar network, is so efficient because it's so large and so extensive, and that basically creates a lot of value to society. The only thing is that if you have such a valuable product and no one else can be competitive against you, you don't have to sell at rock bottom prices. Uh-huh. You can, but you don't want to, because you can sell at higher prices, still offer great deals to your customers, but keeping quite a bit more to yourself. And so that's this two-edged sword, this hero and villain part of these technologies. But it turns out that the villain part is starting to dominate more and more, and this has the negative consequences. And I guess we can get to that. We already talked about some of these myths and these outcomes that we see in the labor market that are slightly distinct from what you would think they are. And they are related to these dominant positions of some of these firms, and we can link them directly.
That's fascinating. So I have a set of questions. Let me maybe start with me trying to press you on the question whether this is exclusively, you know, a digital issue or a tech issue. So is it really the case that there is not nearly as much market power outside of markets that have found ways to, or where firms have found ways to extensively apply new technical solutions or digital solutions to scaling?
So the short answer is that it's more broadly than just tech in two ways. Mm-hmm. It's more broadly than what we narrowly would define as the tech industry, and then think Google, Apple.
Right.
So it's definitely much broader than that. And it's also much broader than just tech. And there's a different reason for it, which is that there are also some network effects, for example, in the beer market, for an mm-hmm. issue that has to do with the way beer is distributed because of regulation and because of laws on alcohol and things like that. And there's nothing tech about it. I'm sure that these companies, Anheuser-Busch, uses tech heavily in their logistics, mm-hmm. but it's more an inherent feature of that distribution network of wholesale and retail that the beer market has, that allows them to create such a dominant position. For example, we don't see it in wine, for example. Okay, and something that's particular to the beer industry. So it is beyond tech. And in fact, our research shows that in the data, we cannot really attribute much to specific sectors. It's in all sectors. Huh. All that said, and with the exception of a company like a beer distributor, we see that a really important component is tech, even if it's in a sector outside tech. For example, right. There's a company called Inditex, you know, some of the brands, but it's kind of the overarching company of all these smaller brands. And Inditex is extremely heavily invested in AI. They have a logistics network that is really fine-tuned on data. And it's because they have that capability that has given them an advantage and a dominant position in a very traditional sector, which is textiles. Mm-hmm. And so I would say that there are exceptions where tech plays no role. In many markets outside the tech industry, tech plays a role. And then, of course, we have tech, where tech is tech, and that's mm-hmm. it's networks. And then, you know, I gave the example of eBay, plenty more, where, of course, data one, but also digital technology in general tends to have this scale effect where large scale really pays off.
Okay. But then let me take a step back and go back to the example of eBay and other networks like that, that ultimately, you know, exploit scale that, then ultimately bestows on them these network effects that you were describing a second ago, where there's tremendous value both for buyers and for sellers to, you know, link into that network and not go to a competitor, because everyone would have to move at the same time effectively for that to make any sense. Why is this an issue, right? I mean, I understand that these networks are then able to exploit their privileged position to a certain extent by charging higher markups, but isn't this somehow like a new kind of market where maybe some of the older rules don't necessarily apply, right? Because you're saying, I mean, there's tremendous value to every party at the end of the day. Is that not just sort of a cost of business in those new kind of markets?
I mean, definitely it's a new kind of market, but the idea of these network effects is not new.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, newspapers are something similar, because it's old style, it's with an old technology, but it's bringing together really readers and advertisers. That's what a newspaper is. And you could say that a lot of the TV is the same thing. You know, you bring together eyeballs and advertisers. That's your business model, and you have two sides to this market. And what's the value of a market like that? Size.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, historically, television, public and private television, has been heavily regulated, because people had understood that there was economies of scale. Now, it's not always the case that scale is dominant. I mean, if you look at the dating market, for example, it turns out that, and that's a very kind of peculiar type of market, because you want it to be large, but you want people to be kind of the type of people you're looking for. And so that's why you have differentiation between platforms, because you have a J-Date for people who are Jewish, you have a site for people who are gay, you have a site for people, you know, have certain religions, ethnic backgrounds, and there is, depending on the market, the application, there is specialization if you want. But each of them in themselves have scale. By the way, in the dating market, they're all owned by Magic of Common, nearly all of them. So you get consolidation in a different way. Yeah. So, you know, even though there's differentiation. And I think that, yes, new technologies are very important for that, because it's a feature that's very common, and I completely agree with you there. But it's not new. And scale is not new, of course. I mean, railway travel, which came about around the turn of the last century, has scale. There's no point, like with two eBays, there's no point in having two railway tracks next to each other to compete.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with electricity provision. We still haven't figured it out perfectly, but it's heavily regulated. If you let electricity being provided in an unfettered competitive market, what you're going to get is one firm. It's a natural monopoly, because there's just no kind of reason to compete in infrastructure like that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether you want to talk already about solutions, but let me hint at solutions is that, you know, if you have such a scale advantage from a network like that, like a train network, rail network rather, or like a power plant with the network of lines that goes to everyone's house, then you want to exploit that advantage, have such a large network, but you want to try and create competition on the network. So you separate basically the network from the providers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we see a lot in electricity markets, that the regulator, the electricity regulator, by the way, you call it a utility, the regulator is going to try and ensure that you have the scale advantage, but ensuring that there's enough competitors on this network, and that's through a set of rules and laws. And then once there's competition between all these providers, you as a customer can now choose between the two providers. What do we have? We have the advantage of one large network, and we have the advantage of competition at the same time. And in the case of coming back to eBay, that would mean that a regulator would say, you know what, eBay, you have to allow other providers like Yahoo Auctions on your network where everyone is.
Mm-hmm.
And Yahoo Auctions can now add a fee. The regulator is going to say how much that fee is. Rent space on your platform. So of course you want to reward eBay for building an efficient, fast, you know, a top platform, and that's what Yahoo Auctions is going to pay for. But they can now compete for all the customers, And right. They're going to say to the customer, instead of paying 7%, let me do it for 5%. Then eBay is going to react and say, well, if I lose my customers for 5%, I'm going to go at 4%. And you'll see price competition between multiple providers. But at the same time, you're going to have still the advantage of that large network. And I think that's a way in which we can, you know, ultimately get competition. Because the answer to the problem here is competition. The answer to the problem is we need more competition. We don't have it naturally in markets where there's scale effects. So we have to do something to bring back competition. And in a sense, you know, competition does wonders when it works. When it doesn't, it does a lot of harm. And ultimately, the profit paradox is a lot about that, the harm that the lack of competition does to many of these markets. And as I said earlier, it's definitely not all markets, all products that are being produced in by dominant firms in a concentrated market. It's just all those technologies which have these features of, you know, scale economies and that create the dominant position for one or a few firms. And those then create a number of consequences on the labor market, on what I call business dynamism, on startup that we talked about in the beginning.
Yeah, absolutely. There are a few other dynamics that I want to discuss real quick. So you mentioned a few examples where dominant companies are effectively able to acquire developers of new technologies and prevent them from diffusing these new tools to their competitors. So I think this is a somewhat peculiar dynamic because it again speaks to this idea that there may be new markets or new ways of doing business where competition is not as easy to materialize. So let's say, or the way that this is typically referred to is that those are learning curve effects. If you have a new industry, as in tech, or you have applications of, you know, say digital technologies where you just happen to be very far along the learning curve and you're just having an advantage where you are able to employ certain technical solutions in a way that nobody else really can because they don't have the wherewithal. And then you're able to create a sort of dominant position that then prevents competitors in the sense that they, even if they see your big margins, it's not that easy for them to set up a similar business. Is that a dynamic that has become much more prevalent? Well, which I'm assuming the answer is yes, but I want you to elaborate on. And then what are some of the measures that these companies then take to keep those technologies from diffusing?
So yes, it's something that's becoming more prevalent. But Nick, in the way you were describing it, it's of course very natural that if new technologies develop, that, you know, there's a learning curve, as you say, the one who's in there first, not only, you know, may be there first and if there's returns to scale can reap the benefits from it, but it's also making the investment that is innovating. And again, this is the hero story of technological change. Joseph Schumpeter argued with creative destruction, that is precisely the engine of growth.
Exactly. Yeah.
But there is one key aspect of Schumpeter's theory, and that is that this advantage that you create, this being ahead on the learning curve through your innovation, and that, you know, provides the incentive to innovate in the first place, that is temporary. And what we're seeing now is with a lot of these new technologies, that this advantage is not at all temporary. It has a much more permanent aspect to it. And this permanent aspect comes from these returns to scale, from these scale economies that allow firms basically to cement their position virtually permanently. Permanently, I mean, as in eternity doesn't exist, because now it's going to be at some point another new technology that's going to take over Google, and who knows what it is. We don't know what it is. But only the fact that firms can be in a position of dominance for 10 years would be already too much. And we're talking about 25 years now, because most of these firms came about in the mid-90s, some earlier, some a little bit later, but that's roughly the time frame. And it's clear that we look at how much profits that they generate and what stock market valuations they create. That's just a sign of the fact that they're really doing very well in profit terms, but also in Schumpeterian terms, they should have been dissipated long before because someone would have copied that technology. And it's very easy to copy an eBay technology. It's very easy to copy Facebook technology. It's much harder to build a base, a base of users and customers. And if, like Facebook, you have, 3 billion, of course, I mean, world population is limited.
Yeah.
And even if you can do it with the same population, as I gave the example earlier between Yahoo Auctions and eBay, to grab the customers from your competitor is very hard because your competitor has no interest in moving. And it's precisely this permanent aspect that is the novelty. Again, I say it's not completely new because railway travel was like that also 120 years ago. But with these new technologies, it's much more common that we have these permanent advantages. Warren Buffett famously said in a speech he gave once, he said, when I invest in a firm, I think of the firm as being a castle, to be a valuable castle. And what I want then is I want to be the person in charge of that castle. The duke of that castle would be someone who's knowledgeable, who's caring for the castle, who knows what the business is about. But above all, I want this castle to have an enormous moat around it. And that moat is there so that no competitors can have access to my castle, and my castle is protected. And the message I have, he says, for my managers is widen the moat. Make sure at least that it doesn't shrink, but widen it. And if needed, you know, throw in some sharks and some gators just to make sure that no one wants to come in. And what is the moat? That's this permanent position of having the ability of not facing competitors. And if you look at Warren Buffett's portfolio over the last decades, I mean, since the start, actually, what kind of companies does he invest in? Visa and MasterCard, network goods. Coca-Cola, it's kind of a different good, but it's also a good that's fairly competitive. He used to invest heavily in Kodak. The technology changed, they disappeared, but it was... all the goods are goods which have basically some form of market power, whether it's built up through the technology itself or it's built up through customer preferences and some form of addiction in the case of Coca-Cola. You know, he realizes that that's the way how you create growth and how you keep competitors out. And growth for him means, of course, higher profits. But what's good for the shareholder is not necessarily good for society at large. And that's where we see these adverse consequences on the economy, which has to do with what I call wage stagnation, the fact that, you know, wages for the 90% of the population haven't grown while productivity kept growing. I mentioned startups declining. You know, startups is basically these competitors. If there's too many of these dominant firms, competitors can't get their foot into the market, so you get fewer of those. We talked about the business dynamism before, that jobs turn over slower, people move about much less often between states. This is, you say, good stability, but at the same time means you don't get promoted, you don't get better opportunities in your job. So you get this kind of sclerotic economy that's not really very dynamic, and the business dynamism is just, you know, the result of decline in the dynamism is the result of that dominant position of these firms who are not really in a competitive market.
Yeah, I think, is this primarily an American phenomenon, though? Because it seems that sometimes, at least, you know, the focus is very strongly laid on big American companies and not so much, European ones, for example.
Well, first of all, there's a lot of these companies that are in the US, but it's our results show it's global. So we see this also the case for European, Asian, African firms. It's everywhere. It's actually fairly similar everywhere. But then there's one aspect to it, which is that given the digital age, many of these products are now global products.
Right.
And in the end, it doesn't matter whether you're using an Apple product and live in California or you use it in Buenos Aires or in Shanghai. Ultimately, it's where the customer is. And it's the customer who's paying too high a price, and it's the customer who's being affected by that dominant position. And then moreover, because there's the effect of these dominant firms, they charge higher prices, they produce less, they demand less labor, and that's global because they have their you know, their call center services globally, they have production globally, they have retail outlets and shops globally. What that means is that basically globally, the consequences are felt, even if many of these firms are all in the United States. But it doesn't really matter where these firms are. I mean, you know, from wherever I am, I can buy stocks, I can own those firms. So the fact that they have a postal address that says, you know, Cupertino, California, or that says New York City, the postal address doesn't really matter. What matters is where the customer is first. Second, the owner can be located anywhere, very distant from that postal address. And so it's we found out that that location doesn't really matter that much. As long as we know where the customers are, we know that given that these are global products, the customers are everywhere. So it's a problem that's global.
So does that mean that the location also doesn't matter for potential solutions, as you were mentioning earlier?
Yes, or put it kind of the saying the same thing, but at a kind of the flip side of it, saying that only a global solution will truly solve the problem. Because if, say, the United States were to, you know, come in and say, we're going to really do something about this, if in Europe they don't do anything about it, you're going to see many of these firms moving about. They all already do, by the way, for tax reasons. You know? Why is some of these companies, or these tech companies, why are they in Ireland? Having, you know, for tax reasons. And again, there it's clear that a postal address doesn't mean anything. But again, to do something about the root cause of this lack of competition, or at least countering the presence of these economies of scale, the only way to truly address this issue is to do this at a global level. There's one piece of good news, which is that in May, last May at the G7, the Biden administration proposed a coordinated action, if you want, for a 15% corporate tax rate. And the reason is to avoid this, you know, let's move to Ireland, let's move to Holland, let's move to Luxembourg, to precisely avoid that. And I think the good news of that is taxes is not going to be a solution to this dominant firm problem, but the coordinated solution is going to be the solution. And that's what I mean is that maybe the next G7, they say, well, we got this this corporate tax rate of 15% through, let's now look at, you know, this dominant position of these global firms. Let's now talk about that. And I think that's going to be the only way forward.
Let's hope so. Professor Jan Eckhout, thank you so much for being part of the podcast.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Political Economy Forum podcast. Please feel free to listen to our other episodes on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You might also like our special podcast on election security, Neither Free Nor Fair, which is hosted by Professor James Long, and is also available on all major platforms.
Our podcasts are produced by Morgan Wack and myself, Nicholas Wichtok. Our theme music was created by Ted Long.
Please feel free to leave a review, as we're curious about your feedback. And if you have any questions, suggestions, or concerns, please contact uwpoliticaleconomy@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you.